On this episode of Skeptico, Alex discusses new research linking brain burst in dying rats to near-death experience and looks back on his interviews with Dr. Lakhmir Chalva and science writer Jeff Wise.
It's interesting that you reference the near-death experience literature. I've had a chance to interview some of the world's leading near-death experience researchers, and gosh, you know, I haven't went back and talked to some of them about this, and I wouldn't find any of them that would even seriously entertain that kind of speculation. As a matter of fact, privately, one of them told me, and this is pretty harsh, but it said it's one of the dumbest explanations for near-death experience yet published. So I guess I was really wondering exactly where you're coming from, exactly what near-death experience research you've dug into that makes you feel like the speculation that you're talking about would fit the broader research that's been done into near-death experience.
So, I mean, I'm not a researcher in near-death experience. That's not my primary scientific interest. We are basically at the bedside taking care of very sick patients in the intensive care unit. And I don't pretend to have any incredible insight into what these are or are not.
But there's this huge disconnect here between the science media and, to a certain extent, the general population.
Right.
In terms of just the published data.
Okay.
Forget any beliefs that I have or anything like that. Just the published data, like I just told you, says that near-death experiences, one, are non-hallucinatory.
Okay.
And they're always perceived as being hallucinatory. And there's this link that's made. And it is so pronounced that I just have to wonder if there isn't something more going on.
Well, I don't know. Is our society hardline materialistic? I mean,
our science is, right? Because that's the disconnect, right? The general population hears about near-death experience and on Oprah or wherever, and they're like, wow, you know, that's really cool. That really relates. I know my uncle did that. But when they turn to science, what they get is just the opposite.
Yeah.
No. It's right around the corner. Oh, here it is. This will probably explain it. Just let it play itself out. Here it is, you know. And it's just not true.
I mean, this idea that a scientific theory is something that, you know, tries to increase our understanding by proposing, you know, making a prediction. Which really, I think the thing that's often overlooked is that a theory requires a mechanism.
Stay with us for Skeptico. Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode, Near-Death Experience Science and the Media. A couple of months ago, there was a scientific study that came out of the University of Michigan that received a lot of media attention, and I heard from a lot of Skeptico listeners asking me about this. It was a study that found a surge in electrical activity in the brains of dying rats, and it offered this as a possible explanation for human near-death experiences. Now, as we've seen in the past, research supporting a conventional explanation for near-death experiences, like this one does, no matter how tentative or speculative the link, those kind of reports receive a lot of attention from the mainstream science media. The study was no exception. There were reports popping up all over the place. BBC, ABC, CBS, Fox, National Geographic. And I know, because as I said, many of you were forwarding these to me. So I created a quick thread in the Skeptico forum, and I linked to an interview I had done a while back with a researcher from George Washington University Medical Center. But I wanted to, in this show format, provide an extended link and a little bit more discussion on that topic. And then as I dug into this a little bit more, I thought of another Skeptico show that I think also speaks to this, and that's an interview that I did back in May of 2010 with science journalist Jeff Wise, who I thought was very open and provided an interesting look into how this happens in terms of this snowball effect and how someone can kind of plant this little meme out there that, hey, there's this new study that explains near-death experience. Don't worry about it anymore. And how that can just have this snowball effect and receive such momentum in the mainstream media. So I'm going to include a clip from that interview in this show as well. So first, let's start with Dr. Lakhmir Chalva, who I interviewed in June of 2011 from George Washington University. Obviously a very bright guy. I came across his work, if you remember, after talking with Dr. Stuart Hameroff at the University of Arizona, and he was hosting his annual consciousness research conference and had invited Dr. Chawla to talk because he thought this finding was important. As you'll hear when I spoke with near-death experience researchers, they didn't seem to think it was quite so important. So here, as I play you this clip, keep in mind that this directly, and I think very conclusively, addresses this recent finding from the University of Michigan. It's the exact same thing, brain surge at death. In Chawla's case, he looked at human beings. The University of Michigan, they looked at rats. The same thing, the same blind spot. It clearly doesn't link to near-death experience research for some very obvious and important reasons. But of course, if you're biased and looking for such a link because you know it has to exist because it supports the existing paradigm, well, then you're likely to find it. At least that's my explanation for how a researcher can be led down this path. Here's the clip from episode 140 of Skeptico. So, Dr. Chawla, in 2009, you published a paper with the surprising discovery that some of your patients who were very close to death experienced a final surge in brain activity, and the paper has gained quite a bit of traction, media attention, mainly because of this quote of yours: "We think that near-death experiences could be caused by a surge of electrical energy as the brain runs out of oxygen." So, first, I wanted to ask you, you know, it's been a while since that paper was published. Do you still think that what you saw has anything to do with near-death experience?
Right. So, you know, obviously all the patients in our study passed away. So there's really no way for us to truly know if what these people were experiencing is, in fact, had they survived, been the signature of a near-death experience. But what we did notice, which was very striking, is that in all these patients, and in this study, we reported on 7 patients for which we had very good documentation. But we've seen these electrical surges of EEG activity at the end of life in over 50 to now over 100 patients. And what we basically have hypothesized is that when people pass away, something occurs in their neural structure. We have a hypothesis for why this may be happening that causes this large intensity of electrical energy. And what we basically hypothesize further and speculate is that if somebody was in the field, someone who was having a heart attack, for example, and their heart stopped and the oxygen to their brain went down and they had this sort of terminal surge of energy, and then they were resuscitated and brought back, it's very likely that they would recall that electrical surge. And if they did recall that surge, we hypothesize and speculate that that could be what people describe in their near-death experiences. Because the one thing that we have seen rather consistently when you read the literature of near-death experiences is that not everyone has the same imagery. Not everyone has the same experience. But the one thing that they all have in common is that the experience is very intense and very vivid. And people can usually recall many, many years later on with great detail what they experienced. And so it would take something that would be a very durable electrical event of energy for someone to have that. And so we put two notions together and arrived at that speculation.
Okay, then I just wanted to confirm that, and it's interesting that you referenced the near-death experience literature. I've had a chance to interview some of the world's leading near-death experience researchers, and gosh, you know, I haven't went back and talked to some of them about this, and I wouldn't find any of them that would even seriously entertain that kind of speculation. As a matter of fact, privately, one of them told me, and this is pretty harsh, but it said it's one of the dumbest explanations for near-death experience yet published. So I guess I was really wondering exactly where you're coming from, exactly what near-death experience research you've dug into that makes you feel like the speculation that you're talking about would fit the broader research that's been done into near-death experience.
So So, I mean, I'm not a researcher in Unit of Experience. That's not my primary scientific interest. We are basically at the bedside taking care of very sick patients in the intensive care unit. And I don't pretend to have any incredible insight into what these are or are not. All we are saying from our group's scientific standpoint is that we see a very consistent signature for patients when they're passing away. And we are not the only investigators to report this. This has now been investigated and reported by multiple investigators. This is not artifact. This is real electrical activity. It's high-frequency gamma wave activity at the minimum. It could be higher frequency than that. And the one thing which is abundantly clear is that this level of activity is coherent electrical activity. This is not sort of, you know, slow theta wave activity. This is not nothing, sort of, you know, dying brain, very sort of escape rhythm type of stuff. So I don't know what's causing it. We've speculated what might be the cause. And I don't know if this is a near-death experience or not. I'm not saying it is or it isn't. But I do believe that it's plausible that if someone has a very large coherent amount of activity and they are then awoken or awakened, they're going to have a memory of that. And that memory could be what people believe to be is a near-death experience. And the one thing which we find rather consistent is that the level of energy associated with this is very high frequency and it's very intense. If you look at the BIS monitor and the SedLine monitors for which these are measured, it pretty much goes to the top of the scale. It goes beyond or very close to the maximum capacity that the device can measure. So I don't know what it is, but I do think it's plausible that if someone has this and they recall it, that they would recall a vivid memory. Whether that's a near-death experience or not, I don't know.
Right. Well, let's just push that a little bit further, and I appreciate where you're coming from, that, you know, near-death experience is a hot topic. Something happens at the final stages of life. I think it's easy to make that connection. The pushback I hear from the near-death experience researchers and why they say, wow, that just doesn't really fit, and we've been down that path before, is a couple of reasons. But the main one is the timing. You know, the first thing they'll tell you is that while near-death experience has certainly been studied a lot in cardiac arrest patients because it eliminates a lot of the other variables, it's not the only place where near-death experiences are reported. The first thing that I heard back from the near-death experience researchers I talked to about your work is most people who report a near-death experience aren't that bad off. They're not in that much of a medical emergency, final stages kind of situation that you talk to. Heck, there's even people who jump off the Golden Gate Bridge and don't have any real physical trauma going on that have a near-death experience, or people who are in the middle of a plane crash scenario that have a near-death experience. So the literature, when you get into near-death experience, goes way beyond people in this medical situation. But moreover, this issue with the EEG becomes very interesting because we also have people in the near-death experience literature, case studies published in places like New England Journal of Medicine, all the right places to publish case studies, where they've induced cardiac arrest and they know there's no EEG, and yet there's the report of a near-death experience.
Right. So I guess it really comes down to your definition on what a near-death experience is or isn't. Is it driving a car and having a Mack truck nearly come and crush you and you avoid it? And that's a near-death experience because you nearly died. And I think that it all depends on what near-death means and what your definition of near-death is. And I think that's an important distinction. And I think that when we talk about near-death, what we're talking about can vary. Patients who are undergoing anesthesia, who have very bad events, people who are getting psychoactive medications, which is a part of critical care and a part of being in the operating room, can all have near-death experiences, and they could have had very traumatic cases in which their hearts never stopped. And so I think there is going to be an enormous amount of heterogeneity on what a near-death experience is or isn't. And in those cases, I certainly agree that people can have things that they recall from the events, but it's very hard because it's very rare for a person to die or nearly die and then be awoken within 15 or 20 minutes, and you can say to them, hey, do you remember anything? Sort of not the nature of a recovery of a very severe near-death event. So there's a lot of things that can go on between an event and the actual recall. And I think that it's very hard to ascertain in any given individual if this electrical spike that we're describing speaks to a very particular type of recollection versus a more generic near-death experience. And I think that this is a testable hypothesis, in fact, but I do think that it's very hard because what your definition or one's definition of a near-death experience varies from investigator to investigator.
Not really, not all that much. Again, this is NDE Research 101. Everyone nowadays uses something called the Grayson Scale, invented by Bruce Grayson. It's in a series of, I think, 7 or 12 questions, and they rate how deep, quote-unquote, the near-death experience is. So when we throw around the term near-death experience, it really has, at this point in the stage of the research, a very specific set of features. It's not really all over the board, kind of like you're saying. So I'm not really sure that there is that much discrepancy in what is or what isn't a near-death experience in terms of the near-death experience literature.
No, I'm not referring to it in the literature and what the case definition is or isn't. I mean, the case definition is that they all agree on what they're using to describe it. What I'm saying is that everyone in our study died, period. They all died. And they all had this electrical spike. And all we are suggesting is that people who survive, who have this, are likely to recall whatever that electrical energy is. And that individual may recall that as an experience or as a memory that occurred as they died or nearly died. That's all we're saying. I'm not suggesting that every person who has a near-death experience has to have this spike, nor am I suggesting that this spike is the signature for all near-death experiences. All we're proposing is that if this is recalled, this could form a very strong memory. And so it may represent a specific subtype of people's near-death experiences. I'm not suggesting that this is the end-all, be-all. We don't have any kind of evidence to make that determination. But I do think it's very interesting that people have this. And what I find further interesting is that animals, when they're killed, also have this electrical spike about 45 seconds to 60 seconds after death.
Mm-hmm. It is a surprising finding. And it's an interesting finding. It's also interesting to me, though, how the story kind of runs way ahead of itself. As you say, you know, I think you're being very straightforward, and I appreciate you kind of putting the spikes in the ground in terms of what you would sign up for and what you wouldn't. The story has kind of taken on a life of its own, and it seems like this happens over and over again when near-death experience is thrown into the mix and we have some kind of conventional explanation for it. We get a lot of traction behind those ideas, even if they haven't been, I don't know, researched quite as fully as we'd all like. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I have been interviewed and spoken to many people about this, and I think it dramatically determines on what the person's predisposition is. If I have this conversation with an atheist, the atheist tells me that you have proven that these near-death experiences are not divine intervention, and you have given evidence for the fact that there is no God. And when I speak to very religious people, they tell me that I have measured the soul leaving the body, and it's a divine event that we are capturing and experiencing and being able to observe. And I think that those two assessments are wildly off base, and you have two sets of people looking at the exact same data, creating the exact opposite conclusion. And, you know, all we can say is that we have an interesting finding. We don't know what it is. And what we strongly believe is that when people pass away, there is little to no research in this arena as compared to, let's say, molecular biology. We simply don't study it in a very thoughtful fashion because this is a time where it's usually reserved for hospice and families and comfort care. And what we're suggesting is that there may be something to be learned at the end of life that may shine a light on what is something that's very important to the stakeholders, which is our patients. Because our patients care very deeply about what happens when they die, as I would argue most people. And what this is or isn't, I don't know. But I do know that the finding is intriguing. And it may explain some patients' recollections, but I certainly don't suggest that it explains everyone's. And there is a very wide group of people who have arrived on a huge post and set of conclusions on a 7-person case study, which I think is highly premature. So our view is that we have an interesting finding, and whenever you have an interesting observation, generally what we do as scientists is study it in more detail to understand what it is and what it isn't. And I think that for the near-death experienced researchers who are, looking at these data and saying, everyone's saying it's this, that, or the other, I would say let's study it.
Right, but I'm not sure that they're saying this, that, or the other. They're saying, okay, let's take your finding, let's take your data, and very logically try and fit it into the rest of the data that we have. And they're saying, you know what, this doesn't really add much to the story that we already have, because we have so many cases that would contradict the kind of conclusion that you're coming to, that this is somehow a near-death experience. And the contradiction is that, you know, we have too many people that have this continuous memory of their entire process of being in the hospital, of then going under, then leaving their body. I mean, hey, not to mention, let me just throw that out there. I don't want to get into too many of the details of the near-death experience research, because I know that's not your thing. But the most profound part of the near-death experience research is this out-of-body experience, this ability to see things from a vantage point outside their body, to hear things from a vantage point outside of their body. And of course, this has been reported repeatedly in case studies, and they've tried to replicate it in other work. But there's no way to connect the OBE part of the near-death experience to your data. But there's also no way to connect the EEG data that they have to your research. So I don't think it's a lot of people coming to conclusions. They're just saying, like they've said in the past when people have come up with and said, oh, it's probably a lack of oxygen, it's probably fear of death. And then they've gone and done the work and said, you know, that doesn't really fit. And that's what I hear them saying again. You know what? This is an interesting, surprising finding, but it doesn't really add much to the research we've already done into near-death experience. Okay, so next I want to play for you the second clip I was talking about from episode 103 of Skeptico and my interview with Jeff Wise. This interview came about after a similar kind of flurry of activity in the science media about a study came out suggesting a link between the carbon dioxide level of blood and near-death experiences. Now, this was exceptionally sloppy reporting, not on the part of Mr. Wise, because as you'll hear, he didn't know any better. He was just kind of following the crowd and following the people that he thought he should trust, the scientists who he thought would have a reasonable handle on this. But the reason it was so egregious was there was so much published work among the near-death experience researchers that conclusively contradicted this idea that near-death experience is related to CO2 levels in the blood. You got to know, this is one of the first things that they looked at. So you can go back and look at research published 10, I think even 15 years ago, that conclusively shows, hey, we looked for, you know, lack of oxygen in the blood. That's not it. And they repeated this over and over and over again. Yet it's an explanation that was kind of backdoored into this study and then trumpeted by the science media. In fact, if you listen to some folks, notably, I was just listening to an interview the other day with Professor Chris French, who many still think of as this open-minded skeptic, but who is really just this ultra, somewhat media-savvy skeptic in the UK. And he was throwing this out there again, you know, CO2 levels in the blood. He was throwing out the Steve Novella kind of thing. Well, it's kind of a lot of combination of different things, and one of them is CO2 levels in the blood. Never mind that this smorgasbord approach is exactly the opposite of a good medical explanation for a phenomena that's been reported across a wide variety of conditions. But maybe I'm sidetracking us a little bit too much. Let's hear from Jeff Wise as to why he felt compelled to publish his story linking near-death experience to CO2 levels. That's fascinating, and that kind of ties into what I wanted to talk about in this research. You're right on target, and I thought it was so interesting because, one, this NDE research was widely reported, and I'm glad that you reported on it, and in particular with your background and with the book, Extreme Fear, there's some interesting tie-ins. But here's the real problem I have with it, is that all those things you're talking about are great and wonderful. They just don't relate to near-death experience. I mean, there's several problems with this research. I mean, first of all, it's relatively small. It's a small little study.
Oh, granted.
The correlation isn't that strong.
Right.
It contradicts earlier research that looked at CO2 in the blood.
Okay.
But here's the real kicker, and it's what relates to, again, the work that you've done and both in your personal experience in adventure travel and about your book.
Right.
And that's that the media has this perception that the near-death experience is about hallucination.
Right.
It's about all these experiences or all these symptoms that are associated with lack of oxygen in the blood, which is what this research is really about. The elevated CO2 levels are really a byproduct of not getting enough oxygen in the blood, as you point out quite correctly in your blog. Well, if you look at near-death experience research, which is well established now for 20 years, what we find is exactly the opposite. People who have a near-death experience have an increased level of lucidity, an increased level of awareness. You know, the most recent research that we reported on here, where they interviewed extensively 1,000 near-death experiencers, 76% of them said that their experience during the near-death experience was more conscious than their everyday life.
Right.
And the data that they report is not hallucinatory at all. 98% of the data that they report is realistic and real.
Right.
So if you have a dream and you see, you know, you're in a car and then suddenly the car turns into a lion and it's, you know, these are hallucinations. These things don't occur in the near-death experience.
So, I mean, I sense that there's an issue here that's bothering you, which is that my report and many of the reports in the media took an essentially materialistic view
all
of the phenomenon.
All the reports in the media.
So,
and it wasn't that hard to really find. I mean, if you look at one step beyond, or the first step of good reporting is, you know, what do the experts in the field say? Hey, the near-death experience research experts, the people like Bruce Grayson at the University of Virginia or Dr. Jeffrey Long at the Near-Death Experience Research Foundation, they were quick to kind of deal with this. And they did it in a nice way, but they said there's nothing here.
Okay.
You know, it contradicts earlier studies. It's very small. And the main point is we've already looked at cerebral hypoxia, which is what this is all about.
Okay.
And there isn't anything there.
Right.
This thing just explodes in the media because it taps into, I think, what a lot of folks want to believe, which is that our consciousness is totally tied to our brain and it's totally tied to fear. Which is the other thing this is tapping into, is that it's a fear or death thing. That's totally been debunked and refuted, but that, you know, persists.
Right. Well, you know, I see that your trouble with this and with my reporting is really has to do with the interface between two kind of conflicting worldviews. On the one hand, stop me if I'm completely off base here, but on the one hand, you've got the view of the human spirit as a kind of an essential thing that is sort of not rooted in an underlying physical mechanism that can be explained in strictly material terms. On the other hand, you have this kind of, you know, I don't want to say post-enlightenment, but, well, why not? Let's call it post-enlightenment. This idea that, like, the world can be kind of understood, you know, as a system of interacting particles and forces, and that, you know, so the psychology, particularly in the last, I don't know, 20 or 30 years, you know, since the downfall of Freud, essentially has been an attempt to find mechanical corollaries to every aspect of human consciousness. And so I will plead guilty. I mean, essentially you and I are coming at this issue from different camps, I think. Whereas because I'm perceiving that you are maybe someone in human soul is an immortal essence.
I like to take all that stuff out of it. And because I think that, you know, the philosophical implications and the lack of kind of a theoretical basis for how consciousness could survive bodily death
right. Is
wide open. It opens up a million questions. But I think the starting point has to be with how do we do good science and how do we do good science reporting? And I'm not trying to call you out here because you write a blog every day for Psychology Today.
Right.
This obviously tapped into a lot of the topics that you're interested in. And you didn't handle it. You handled it better than most of the people that I read about.
Right.
But there's this huge disconnect here between the science media and, to a certain extent, the general population.
Right.
In terms of just the published data.
Okay.
Forget any beliefs that I have or anything like that. Just the published data, like I just told you, says that near-death experiences, one, are non-hallucinatory.
Okay.
And they're always perceived as being hallucinatory. And there's this link that's made. And it is so pronounced that I just have to wonder if there isn't something more going on, just in terms of the need for our society to reinforce and kind of prop up this hardline materialism, even when the data doesn't support it.
Well, I don't know. Is our society hardline materialistic? I mean, I
our science is, right? Because that's the disconnect, right? The general population
right. Hears
about near-death experience and on right. Oprah or wherever, and they're like, wow, you know, that's really cool. That really relates. I know my uncle did that. But when they turn to science,
right. What
they get is just the opposite.
Yeah.
No. It's right around the corner. Oh, here it is. This will probably explain it. Just let it play itself out. Here it is, you know. And it's just not true.
This idea that a scientific theory is something that, you know, tries to increase our understanding by proposing, making a prediction by saying, okay, well, we're going to say that, the Earth orbits around the sun, therefore we would expect to see this motion of the planets or something like that. What's really, I think, the thing that's often overlooked is that a theory requires a mechanism. And this is why Freud ultimately, I think, was cast aside, because Freud had a lot of interesting ideas and suppositions about how the brain worked, but he never offered any mechanisms. And so we're entering an age, and I think what you're saying is true, is that more and more you're seeing a materialistic, mechanistic view of human psychology coming to the fore, which is very much out of sync, I think, with the popular culture.
But it's out of sync with popular physics. I mean, quantum physics, which is what runs your TV and your GPS system and all that, they don't even have any kind of sense of materialism. I mean, it's so long gone from that it doesn't. But that's a whole other topic.
Yeah.
As is Freud, which I would have to interject because it's kind of a hot button for me. I mean,
oh, really?
I think we moved away from Freud because he was completely discredited as a fraud. I mean, he published fraudulent research for patients that he never really saw. And if that work was done today, we wouldn't even be so delicate in parsing, you know, why and how, you know, his theories might not hold up. We just say he's a fraud. We shouldn't follow. We shouldn't take seriously anything he said.
You know, I recently ran across a statement by somebody who's writing about science and said, you know, we need to keep politics out of science. And that struck me as funny because, to me, science in a way is politics. An idea doesn't become accepted because on its own merit. It becomes accepted because people form consensus about it. And I think what you're talking about here regarding to near-death experiences is that you feel that on a scientific forum, your view of it is in the minority and that you're not getting a fair shake. You feel like your research is not given its due. And, you know, in a way, it's just like...
Let me fine-tune that there. And I appreciate you playing this out for me because I realize, you know, this is not exactly where you're coming from or where you've gone on it.
Right.
A couple episodes back, I interviewed Dr. Jeff Long, the guy who published the most comprehensive near-death experience research to date.
Uh-huh.
Hey, his book shot to the New York Times bestseller list within 8 days of publication. So we can't say that there's this massive conspiracy to hold back this information. No, it's out there.
Right.
What I notice, and what I was trying to just dialogue with you a little bit about, is that when we turn to science and we turn to science journalism, there's a different code. And the code is applied with this invisible hand. And that is that you're going to stick to this line. And you're not going to venture out and say these other things that do point to all those spiritual aspects and all that. But you're not even going to go there because you're going to be viewed as being unscientific. And it's such a contradiction because, as I pointed out, in this case, the science really points the other direction.
You know, I that's not what it feels like from my perspective. I mean, to me, it feels like, look, I near-death experience is something that I'm interested in. As I started to say earlier, you know, I've been gathering string on various phenomena related to mortal danger. And it's one, you know, I put in my blog, like, I've never experienced my life flashing in front of me, and I'm not really even sure what it's like. You know, is it like watching a movie? Is it like watching a slideshow? But at any rate, it's interesting to me, but I've only tangentially touched on it. So basically, you're talking to a guy who ran across this study, tried to tie it into what he already knew about carbon dioxide levels in the blood and panic and so forth. So I don't know this other research that you're talking about, but when you mention these guys who claim that, you know, I guess they found evidence that, you know, that near-death experiences cannot be explained through materialistic explanations and so forth. It's not that I'm afraid to look into it, but it doesn't really fit into my schema for how I basically have come to conclude the world works. So it's not fear so much as kind of it doesn't really mesh into how I believe the world fundamentally works. And I think that's really the problem. If you're trying to propose a theory or a view of a phenomenon that is radically at odds with how, let's say, mainstream science views the operation of the world, you know, not to say it's impossible. I mean, that's how real, profound revolutions take place.
Hold on, Jeff, because I think you were going one direction where I'd completely agree with you, and that is that when we propose things in science that go against our observed world,
right,
our five senses,
right,
I think it makes us uncomfortable. And I think that's what you're alluding to. At the same time, that's the challenge of the times we live in, and the challenge of the science reporter is virtually all science at this point goes beyond what we experience in the world.
Right.
Everything since Einstein,
yeah,
contradicts our experiential existence, right? So the whole I still don't understand how time can be nonlinear. You know, I mean, time to me is linear.
Absolutely.
There was yesterday, today, and there's tomorrow. But I have to accept that theoretically, you know, time is not linear and that time and space have this relationship that I don't understand. The same is true with consciousness. The data's in, it's clear, it's unambiguous, in some way that we don't understand because we don't really even understand consciousness. We don't understand it at all.
Yeah.
But in some way we don't understand, consciousness survives death. I can say I don't understand that, I don't know that, but I can look at the data scientifically and say, yep, that's what the data says.
I think that's perhaps where I would part ways with you.
Is that the data doesn't say that?
I mean, I know that your listeners are probably very well acquainted with the data. So I don't want to like discuss whether the data is legitimate or not, but to sort of explain, you know, from my point of view, I mean, I think you wanted to talk to me to sort of talk to somebody who is on the other side of this debate and kind of get a sense of why.
No, well, I do that all the time. I talk to all the researchers who are on the other side of it. So
right.
No, I appreciate everything you said already. What I really want to tap into is, as a science reporter, how you deal with it. And you've done a fair job of that. I hear you. You're saying it doesn't fit with your worldview, and therefore the data would be a huge leap. You can't dig into every topic that you come across, so you basically have to stick with what's the kind of commonly accepted view of things.
Not what's commonly accepted, but what's accepted by me. You know, when we approach the world, it's a very interesting question to me, why we find something interesting. We're filled with, you know, of all the things that we could, look at, turn our attention to, listen to, think about, we selectively narrow it down to a very small subset. And I think the answer to that question is that we're interested in things that make sense in the context of everything else that we know, but that's novel. It's new. So things that are boring that we see every day, we're not interested in. Things that completely don't make any sense, or we can't possibly, we have to completely deconstruct our entire worldview in order to incorporate them, those things also aren't interesting.
Yeah, I think you're right. Okay, there you have it, a look back on a couple of interviews that I think perhaps shed some new light on current research and, of course, the way science is dealing with this research on near-death experience. So that is, I guess, the question that I would tee up from this interview. We've just taken a look back on a couple of interviews that are at least 2 years old, and here we are in 2013, and we can point to exactly the same thing happening in terms of even research being recycled, as I think it is, and in terms of the University of Michigan study, and certainly the same pattern happening in the media in terms of blowing up any story that offers a conventional explanation for near-death experience. So the question is, has science moved towards accepting near-death experience science? Do you see any real movement in this direction? Or is it just the same old story of acceptance among the quote-unquote spiritual crowd, but no real movement within mainstream science? So those are some thoughts to chew on. I'd love to hear from you, hear your opinions on that. Of course, the place to do that is in the Skeptico Forum at skeptiko.com, where you can link on over to the forum, or right there on the website where you can add a comment. Love to hear from you, love to dialogue with you and hear different opinions on these topics. It's great to see new people come into the forum. People sometimes leave the forum and then come back a lot later, or leave comments and then you won't see them for a year and then they pop up again. But I think that's a natural part of the process. It certainly was and is for me in terms of trying to get my arms around new information. There's a lot of popping in and out that we do and revisiting things, and I hope that Skeptico is one of those resources that you can occasionally touch back on and see where we're at. And in that same spirit, I hope you'll invite others to come dip their toe into the Skeptico waters and see what they find. So that's going to do it for this episode. I have a number of episodes coming up. Again, they're kind of piling up. It's a little bit too much for me to promise to get a new episode out every week, especially with new material. That's why I kind of popped this one in there that allowed me to kind of republish some old material. But we'll just have to see how it goes in terms of getting out new shows. Glad you're with me. Hope you stick around. Until next time, take care and bye for now.